Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight, three times the charm, is award-winning journalist Kenneth Miller. And we're continuing our conversation about his new book, Mapping the Darkness, The Visionary Scientists Who Unlocked the Mystery of Sleep. Ken, welcome back to the show, third time's the charm.
Truly, thanks for having me.
This is such a fascinating book, and that's why I'm having you back. I think it's one of my absolute favorite science books of the last year. I want to talk about, in the very beginning of the chapter, Crossroads. You talk about that sleep science often violates the precepts of Occam's razor. I just want you to expand on that, because it's true based on what I've read in your book.
Yeah, so Occam's razor is an old philosophical concept that if you have two explanations or multiple explanations for any phenomenon, the simplest one is most likely correct. It's sort of a principle of scientific elegance. And that is true in many instances, but in the case of sleep science and some other sciences, it really is the opposite. As time went on, the truth behind sleep science turned out to be more and more complicated. People started out thinking it was just things like, well, we went to sleep because at night we had less blood flow in our brains. And, you know, a century later, it was clear that, no, actually we go to sleep because, like, dozens of different neurophysiological things are going on that are all interacting in complex feedback loops. And to understand sleep, you really need to understand all of that stuff.
It's amazing. And all of this discovery happens in a relatively short period of several decades. It's amazing when you compare it to, like, the science of astronomy goes back hundreds of years. But a lot of the sleep science that you write about in this book, really things just keep escalating as the 20th century moves along.
Yeah, I mean, sleep science really didn't get started at all until the 19th century, mid to late 19th century, when, you know, industrialization meant that you had to understand what people's needs for sleep were to make them efficient workers. And it didn't really get started into a serious thing until the 1920s, when Nathaniel Gleitman started the first full-time sleep lab. So it's really just been a century. In fact, it's the century mark is this year, because he started his lab in 1925,
right.
And here it is, 2025. The bulk of progress has happened in exactly the past century.
Well, one of the things that is figuring into sleep science, as you write about in these final chapters, is the idea of circadian rhythms. And it becomes important when people talk about sleep, and we're talking about the discoveries of Alexander Borbély.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about, yeah, so, I mean, people may think that idea of circadian rhythms is old. It isn't that old.
Yeah, well, you know, it has its roots. So circadian rhythms are, you know, if you don't know, it's the circadian means about a day. So it is rhythms that our bodies and brains hew to that are approximately 24 hours. And the first observation of this was really in the 1730s when the Comte de Meyron in France observed that if you locked plants in a closet in the dark, they still kept opening and closing their leaves on a 24-hour cycle. Why they did that was very, very mysterious. And evidence for what was going on started to emerge really also in the 1920s, when a guy named Richter started doing experiments with rats and found that they also had inborn 24-hour-ish cycles, even if you raise them in constant lighting situations. And so, you know, just over the decades, this sort of started, the knowledge of this started to expand, and the idea, Richter coined the term the biological clock.
Right, right.
That he thought all animals had. So initially, sleep science was divorced from this science of circadian rhythms, because Nathaniel Gleitman thought, well, human beings are not like animals. We are really governed by our cerebral cortexes, you know, our thinking brains. Animals are different. And that sort of became the party line for sleep science until the 1960s.
That's not that long ago. I was alive.
Yes, absolutely. And in the 1960s, a guy named Jürgen Aschoff in Germany started doing experiments in a bunker where he had human beings trying to change their sleep patterns or trying to live in a situation where where there were really no external cues of darkness and light. And it turned out that people's clocks did all sorts of weird stuff. They persisted in their cycles, but they drifted weirdly. And so it became clear that something was going on in humans. It was the same as in plants and animals. And then in 1973, it was discovered that there's actually a master clock in the brain that governs all these things. It's called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, and it's behind our eyes, and it gets feedback. It gets information from different nerves in our eyes than the ones that govern our conscious brains, and it sets this clock, which actually governs our biological rhythms. So it was in 1973 was really when we finally settled the question, and it turned out that all mammals have this have something in their brain that is in fact a master clock governing all these other clocks. And all of our cells have clocks.
So it's in our DNA.
So it's in our DNA.
Now this brings us to the sort of the last big scientist of sleep science. And that's Mary Karskadon?
Karskadon,
excuse me. Yeah. She becomes really interested in sleeping patterns in teenagers. And the stuff that she finds is really fascinating. What were her sleep campers?
So Karskadon, you got to go back. Karskadon is sort of a direct heir to Nathaniel Kleitman, the founder of sleep science. Kleitman, founded sleep science. He had one of his prominent students was William DeMent, who founded the first modern sleep science.
Oh, yeah.
Sleep medicine clinic. Founded the field of sleep medicine and the first modern sleep clinic at Stanford University in 1970. And in 1970, Mary Karskadon came to work as his lab assistant, just as this sleep clinic was opening. And Karskadon was just, this is a small town girl. She was actually a cousin of DeMent's wife, and he'd seen her at a wedding said, hey, you want a job? Come work for me at the lab. She was just freshly out of college, not sure what she wanted to do. And by 1973, she was leading some really complex experiments with this on circadian rhythms and biological clocks and stuff like that. And so she decided to go to grad school, and for her PhD thesis, she got very curious about why, particularly what are the sleep needs of children and adolescents, and do our needs change in adolescence, in our teenage years? And everybody has observed, she had observed, as all everybody, all parents do, that teenagers seem to have different sleep needs than younger kids, right? They want to sleep really, really late, and they also want to stay up really, really late. And she wondered, well, is this a social phenomenon or a biological phenomenon? And it had been assumed that the prevailing wisdom was that it was a social thing. Teenagers, they have more homework, they have very lively social lives, they want to stay out late partying, etc. But she wondered if that was really true. And so she, in 1976, started a decade-long series of experiments called the Stanford Summer Sleep Camp, in which every summer for 10 years, she commandeered a dorm at Stanford and had at four or five students, kids at a time, between the ages of 8 and 12 who would come in. And they do all sorts of summer camp stuff. They play volleyball and have cookouts and go bowling and stuff like that. But at night, she subjected all of them to the same sleep regimen, where they would go to bed at a certain time, get up at a certain time. They would each have an opportunity to sleep for 10 hours. And then throughout the day, she would periodically measure how sleepy they were. And she had developed the first objective test of sleepiness. And this is another of her great contributions, called the Multiple Sleep Latency Test, or MSLT, in which she would put people into a darkened room every 2 hours and say, okay, close your eyes and try to sleep. And she would then measure using a polygraph, which is, you know, an EEG machine that's also got, can measure your muscle impulses and stuff, tell if you're really sleeping and how deeply you're sleeping and what your brain waves are doing. And she would measure them, and she would then give them a score as to how quickly they fell asleep. And the sleepier you are, objectively, the more quickly you fall asleep during an MSLT. And so she started measuring this during the day on kids. And what she discovered was that that as the kids entered adolescence, it was kids 8 to 12, as they got around 11 or 12, they started, no matter how, you know, they all had the same amount of sleep, but the older kids started being much sleepier during the day, especially during the afternoon. And that was the first indication that our sleep needs actually change biologically in adolescence. She went on to do more complicated experiments to really prove that.
Well, what happened is, first of all, she came up with the term chronic sleep debt. That the fact that we have a chronic shortage of sleep. And although she was doing the summer camp, when the school year happened for these teenagers, that's when things really went awry.
Yes, it's true. Because another subject of debate was, if we don't get enough sleep for a period of time, can we make up for it?
Right.
You know, and the question was, well, can we just make up for it by sleeping late on weekends? And it turned out she was able to prove that no, in fact, you get a sleep debt which accumulates with time. And so for teenagers who it seemed needed at least as much sleep as younger kids, and that was, you know, another thing she discovered. The idea initially was that younger kids need the most sleep, and as you get older, as you enter your teens, you need less. Teenagers need at least as much, and they cannot, by sleeping late on weekends, it's just not enough to make up for the amount of deprivation they're experiencing during the week. And what's worse is, if you sleep late on the weekends, when you have to get up late again on Monday, it's a real shock to the system, and it throws your circadian rhythms off further. And the way schools in America and many other countries are set up is on the assumption that teenagers need less sleep. So high school generally starts, middle school generally or junior high usually starts earlier than elementary school, and high school starts earlier than middle or junior high. That, she discovered, it goes exactly contrary to the biological sleep needs of adolescents.
It's amazing, because she also expands her studies to start looking at the elderly and sleep patterns.
Yeah.
And that's a completely different situation.
It is. And she was one of the earliest scientists to study sleep patterns in the elderly. And others took up where she had left off. Older people typically need, on the shorter end of the sleep scale. So adults in general tend to need 7 to 9 to be fully rested, 7 to 9 hours. Most elderly people are on the lower end of that scale, but the promise is that as you get older, your sleep patterns are more disrupted. You have brief periods where you stop breathing called apneas. You have to go get up and go to the bathroom more often. You tend to toss and turn more, have dry mouth, all sorts of, and there may even be electrophysiological, neurophysiological things going on in your brain that make you more subject to disruption. So one thing you'll see in older people is we tend to nap during the day quite a bit. And that turns out to be something that's actually because our sleep patterns are disrupted during the night.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight, three times the charm, is award-winning journalist Kenneth Miller. And we're continuing our conversation about his book, Mapping the Darkness, The Visionary Scientists Who Unlocked the Mysteries of Sleep. What's interesting is you get to this level of sleep science, and all of a sudden, it's the things that lack of sleep seem to be leading scientists into different sort of strands of research. For instance, the connection between sleep and catastrophes. And one of the things that precipitated this was the Challenger disaster, but also vehicle accidents and so on and so forth. Talk to me about how sleep and the chronic sleep debt has led to a resurgence in catastrophes.
Yeah, so, you know, for a long time, people really thought that sleep was, people, you know, it was a nice thing to have if you could get it, but you could get by with very little. I mean, this was the conventional wisdom, say, in the 1920s. And as society gets more and more, you know, complicated, and scientists have studied this more, they've discovered that, in fact, the consequences of sleep deprivation are really serious on a societal, on a public health level, not just on a personal level. And so one of the things that gave rise to this was in the 1980s, William DeMent, you know, the father of sleep medicine, started looking into what is the effect of insufficient sleep on society at large. And he found that, and he and other scientists who were studying this found that, yeah, people who weren't sleeping enough were having more industrial accidents, and having more car crashes. You would go into something called a micro sleep if you weren't getting enough sleep that you're not even aware of, and this can lead to car crashes. And the biggest example of this that really caught public attention was in 1986, the space shuttle Challenger exploded, killing, I think it was 7 astronauts and raining debris over a wide swath of North America. And when the investigation was held, it turned out that a big factor in this was that NASA engineers who had to decide whether to launch on that morning were heavily sleep deprived. They pulled 2 near all-nighters in a row, and they were not thinking clearly, and they were irritable. And there was evidence was presented to them. They knew about this, that if they launch when the temperature was below, I think, 50-something degrees, these valves or gaskets in the engines in the rocket,
right, the O-rings,
would crack and wouldn't work properly. And that morning, the temperature was in the 30s on Cape Canaveral, and they had to make a decision. And they said, "Oh, to hell with it! Let's just go ahead." And that was the principal cause of the shuttle disaster. When this came out, that gave DeMent and his colleagues a real talking point, and they went before Congress and said, "Look, you know, this is one example of other stuff that's going on." It turned out that the Chernobyl disaster also was caused in part by sleep deprivation. 3 Mile Island nuclear meltdown.
Well, as I read in your book, deaths from all causes peaks between 4 and 6 a.m. too.
Yeah. Yeah, and all this, and so the rates of things like car crashes and industrial accidents and so forth, and the kind of car crashes or vehicle accidents, really, because they meant what they were measuring was single vehicle truck crashes, and various things like that follow the patterns of your circadian rhythms, which include, you know, bouts of sleepiness in the late afternoon and also after midnight. People are just less alert, and that includes people who are on night shift, truck drivers who are driving at night. Your alertness dips, your need to sleep rises, and you're much more prone to accidents.
Now, the great thing is that you got to visit Mary in her laboratory.
Yes.
That's a huge deal. So, like, one of the giants of sleep science, and you got to actually see where she worked and meet her.
Yeah. 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 It was so exciting. She operates out of a 2-story colonial style clapboard house on the campus of Brown University, which was built in the 1920s. And from the outside, just looks like a family house, an old family house. And you go inside, and in the basement is this sleep lab that she's been operating since about 1990. So, you know, for 35 years, at the time I visited her, you know, somewhere around 30 years. And she's got, the whole place is decorated with memorabilia of her career, you know, since 1970, old posters from sleep meetings.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, it's just really cool. So you're taking a walk through the past. And then one of the most exciting things was in the basement, she has stored several, maybe half a dozen polygraph machines that she has used in this, 50-year, you know, her over the course of her 50-year career. Some of them that were donated to her when she started her lab by her mentor, William Dement, who founded Fleet Medicine. And, you know, you can go and touch these things and look at them. And they were extremely modern in their times, and now they look like antiques. And it's just, if you're a sleep nerd like me, it's really exciting.
How did you find her as a person?
She is the most unpretentious, lovely, funny person. And, you know, she's in her mid-70s now, and she's very young at heart. She's got, you know, cropped white hair with a purple streak that she's dyed down the middle. She wears athletic togs, and she's just really what my father would have called a pistol, a live wire.
I love hearing that.
Yeah, yeah, very, very cool person. And she's also, you know, one of the things that also struck me is that she was mentored by William Dement.
Right.
Dement was mentored by Nathaniel Gleitman. And she is mentoring the next generation of sleep scientists. And this was very lovely. I, you know, as she was touring me around her lab, we would bump into young, what I now consider to be young kids, you know, people in their 20s and 30s. Who are catching the fire from her, and she's inspiring them, instructing.
I love that.
And they, you know, they're clearly like big fans, and they would just stop and sort of be agog as this legendary figure would stop and talk to them kindly.
Her first major paper, which was published in 1990, was Patterns of Sleep and Sleepiness in Adolescence, and it sounds very like, yeah, okay, but it was that's a groundbreaking paper.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, what she did, I mentioned we talked about the Stanford Summer Sleep Camp. That was her first foray into the special sleep needs of adolescents. And then once she started her own lab at Brown University in 1985, she started really drilling down on, okay, so what does this mean in the real world?
Right, and what can we do to change the sleep debt?
Exactly, exactly. What can we do? Because so for the first thing she needed to discover was, well, what effect is this really having on kids? And so she started doing surveys of middle and high school kids, and she found that large proportions of them were falling asleep at least once a week in class, which could impair their grades and test scores and stuff like that. And she also started, you know, she started trying to very, in a very fine-grained kind of way, figure out what the difference is, when this kicks in and what it means. And so she found that even when you have adolescents and pre-adolescents going to the same school, which would be a middle school, once the kids start showing the physical signs of puberty, they also start expressing on their surveys what they call a delayed sleep phase, a real need to sleep, to stay up later and get up later in the morning, even if they're going to the same school and having basically the same social life. So that helps really establish that this is a biological, not just a social phenomenon. And then later in the 90s, she started studying what are the consequences of this sleep debt in adolescence. And she found that it included not only impaired grades and test scores, but also higher rates of drug use, alcohol use, tardiness, absences, and things like that that really affect kids' school careers and their health, and in some cases, you know, car crashes, their very lives.
But the amazing thing is there is a fix. I mean, there's a way to deal with this, and that is to start the starting bell for school later.
Yes. And so one of the things she did was she was not just a scientist, she also became an activist, and she would go and present her findings not just to academic meetings, but also to school boards, state and local school boards, and to government bodies, legislators and so forth, arguing that what really needed to happen was school start times needed to be later for middle and high school kids. And she basically started what has become a global movement to start school later, and which has begun to become successful. Really, just slowly in the 1990s, the first school, Edina, Minnesota, became the first school district to actually push back school start times for high school kids. It was followed by Minneapolis. And slowly, city by city, other school districts started doing this, not only in the United States, but in other countries. And in 2020, California became the first, I can't remember if it was 2019 or 2020, California became the first state to legislate school start time, later school start times for high school. And in 2023, Florida became the second state. So her work has really had an impact. It's begun to have an impact across the country and around the world. Although the majority of high schools in the United States, something like 80%, still start at 8 o'clock in the morning or earlier, which is too early for the health of our teenage kids.
I want to end this interview with a quote in your book from Ossarinsky's son Armand. They all had a burning desire to find out, and they were willing to go to hell and back. And that sums it up. My guest tonight, returning, is Kenneth Miller, again, award-winning journalist, and has written one of the best, most fascinating books on science and the evolution of science, because it all pertains to each one of us. We all have to sleep. The book is Mapping the Darkness, The Visionary Scientists Who Unlocked the Mysteries of Sleep. Ken, it's been a pleasure.
And for me, too. Thank you so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.